Clerk will note the roll. On the agenda, we have two bills. Representative Demers, House File 434, excuse me, and House File 1548, which is my bill. I will move Representative Demers' bill, House File 434, be recommended to pass and sent to the full Commerce Committee. Both of these bills' members are essentially the same. Representative Demers' bill has the funding stream is carried out a little further than mine. Mine provides the appropriation for the genomics partnership for this biennium. But I'll let Representative Demers explain the bill, and we'll act on his bill first and then take up mine immediately after. Representative Demers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Good afternoon. This bill is part of the medical biotechnology and medical genomics initiative that the governor and we have been talking about for the last couple of years. We have in the bonding bill, as you may know, the money to put a condominium on the Stabile building down in Rochester that the partnership would use. The funding that these bills talk about is actually for the equipment, staffing, supplies, and that sort of thing to operate the buildings. My bill actually is $15 million for each of the next 5 years for a total of $75 million appropriation. Representative Cole's bill is, as he says, is about the same, except we're just doing it for the biennium, and we'll have to see which one of those works out the best. Members, this is, as you know, and you know, this is kind of a story we've all been talking about, we've all been excited about, the potential for the entire state when we're talking biotechnology and biotechnology and medical genomics, I get those words mixed up. It's just tremendous, and it touches many, many sectors of our economy, from, of course, human anatomy and medicine to agriculture and, of course, to technology. And the spin-off business from this has been talked about in the Trip Unbox study, which I think Drs. Powler and Eric, your last name, we'll talk about. Kind of chronicles for us the dynamic impact that this could have on our state going forward in terms of economic development. So with that, Mr. Chair and members, I'll let the doctors who know a lot more about this than I do give their testimony.
Thank you, Representative Demer. Dr. Weaver or Dr. Pauler, whoever's going to start, go ahead. Eric. Please introduce yourself for the tape.
I'm Eric Weaver. I'm the director of the Genomics Research Center at Mayo and the project director on the Mayo side for the Minnesota Partnership for Biotechnology and Medical Genomics. I'd like to thank you for inviting us here to talk about the operating funds for the Minnesota Partnership. We're assuming some familiarity with the overall goals of the partnership because of our previous testimony here in support of the bonding initiative. So I will quickly go through a few reminder slides, and then Dr. Pallor will focus on the financial aspects of the operating request that we've got to put before you today. So this is what we promised to do back in 2003. One of the questions that came up at our last appearance before this committee was, how are we doing in terms of our commercialization activity? So this slide is intended to provide a 50,000-foot view on that. And the fact that we have recognized as partners in this initiative the value of working closely together. So if you take the NIH dollars that the university gets and the NIH dollars that Mayo gets and put them together and put them on the NIH rankings in terms of institutions who get NIH funding, we rank in the top five together, and that's both in terms of dollars and in terms of the numbers of awards. So this addresses our competitiveness in terms of doing the science and creating the intellectual property that will be the engine that moves this forward. On the commercialization side, there was a recent report from the MIT Technology Review, which looked at success in institutions in terms of commercialization activities. And again, together we're in the top 10 for the number of patents received and the amount of license income received. And this attests to our ability to not only generate the intellectual advances that move these sciences forward, but to move them into the commercial marketplace as well. I won't go into the details of this. This is, the proof of principle form for the partnership and how we've used the initial $2 million allocation from the state to create the partnership and fund some initial projects. Suffice it to say, after a long competitive process, We chose the top science, and these came out in the areas of obesity, Alzheimer's, heart disease, and prostate cancer. And there has actually been significant progress from these projects since the funding was allocated in May 2004, and that's shown here. And we discussed this in more detail last time, so I won't dwell on it today. The request from the partnership over the next 5 years is for $70 million to support our operational funding, and we feel this should be a priority for Minnesota. There is competition, as Dr. Peller is going to tell you about in a minute. We feel that this would build upon previous and continuing investments from both institutions to put us in the most competitive position to continue our solid track record in this regard. And we feel that the benefits for Minnesota, both in terms of leadership in the area of the biotech revolution and in terms of economic return, as Dr. Peller will be discussing, have the potential to be substantial if we're funded at this level.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Mark Peller. I'm the Assistant Vice President for Research at the University of Minnesota Academic Health Center. This slide summarizes why we are pointing out the urgency of this project and what makes us so worried. You've all heard about the investments in California and the investments in Florida, and those are on the coast and pretty far away from Minnesota. But Wisconsin, which is awfully close, and shares a lot of our Midwest values and competes for some of the same faculty who are willing to put up with snow and cold weather to take advantage of the benefits of the upper Midwest. Wisconsin is investing $750 million in similar projects, and that really represents the most immediate threat to Minnesota. So we've invested heavily already, and we certainly will be able to maintain our position at the front of things if we're able to continue to invest. This slide shows how we intend to allocate the funds over the next 5 years. You can see that in year three, we have some extra dollars, $3 million allocated to what we've called programmatic backlog, which are the projects that we reviewed the first time around and didn't have enough money to fund when we did our pilot project. So there were 9 finalists. We could only fund 4 of them, and we would like to fund several more of those, and that could start almost immediately. We also plan in the next 2 years to invest in infrastructure being some cutting-edge equipment in bioinformatics, in our ability to do clinical trials, in our ability to do genomics and proteomics. And just to look ahead at the other end of the operating budget, in years 6 and 7, we have 10% of the budget allocated for what we call technology development. And that's really applied research and development to the intellectual property that we develop out of the partnership to really develop the products prior to the stage when angel investors or venture capital funds would be willing to invest in those projects. So we're going to really add value to those to ensure their success in the commercial market. There are a number of principles to the use of this fund that I just wanted to point out, because the world of research is a little bit different than some of the other aspects of finance that you often deal with. One of the things that we certainly want to do is to fund the best science, and so this is going to be peer-reviewed. As partners, we've decided we don't want an even one-to-one split. We want the money to be available to the partnership, and the money will be spent on the best use of those funds. We certainly need to be sure that we are able to use the funds for the actual costs of doing this research. And as Representative Demmer said, this includes salaries, supplies, equipment, facilities maintenance, not the construction of the facilities, but their ongoing upkeep, and the administrative costs and for regulatory compliance, et cetera, that's involved in this research. We also need realistic time frames. One of the things that I need to share with you how we go about hiring a new faculty member, for example, is that we really have to have funds actually truly committed before we'll start a search for a high-profile faculty member. Before we can start the search, we need the commitment, and then it may take a search committee 6 months or so to identify the best candidates by the time we get them to actually move their laboratories, et cetera. It's a period of time that may be more than a year. So we just need to keep that in mind. You've seen the slide before. Hopefully you've seen the slide several times before, but I want to remind you, and I'm going to make some different points this time. Trip Umbach, some outside healthcare consultants, were hired to do an economic benefits analysis for the partnership, assuming that there would be $70 million invested over the next 5 years. That's a given. The first three bars there in 2010 look at three possible outcomes for that investment of $70 million. The red bar is a pessimistic viewpoint. The blue bar is a very optimistic viewpoint. And the yellow bars is probably the most realistic scenario. That being the case, the annual total economic impact of the partnership is estimated to be about $319 million a year in the mid-level scenario. Next slide. What I want to point out, though, is that the difference between the pessimistic and the optimistic and the mid-level scenarios depends upon a lot of other things coming together. And we started off assuming that there would be $70 million invested, which would allow us to get a critical mass of new faculty who we already have who would be funded, a critical number of projects working, a critical mass of intellectual property coming out of the partnership, a critical mass of startups working together. There's a lot more efficiency of having several startups in an incubator park than just one, because they can often share with each other, use knowledge gained from one another, etc. And so it's quite possible that if we do not get full funding for the partnership, that we will not be able to use the mid-level or the optimistic projection, and that we would actually be in the more pessimistic one, and then the returns would be much less. And then specifically with regards to the returns to the state, so this is looking at projected actual government revenues in terms of taxes of various types, payroll and other corporate taxes. The mid-level scenario shows that the state would basically be paid back starting 5 years from now for its investment. But that's clearly not the case if we look at the pessimistic scenario in the red bar, in which case the payback would be less than the initial investment. And I make this point because of the various bills that have been introduced in the House and in the Senate. The funding amounts are different, and we've really done the analysis, et cetera, assuming that there would be the $70 million invested by the state over the next 5 years, plus additional investments by private sector. And so that's something that I do want to point out as the potential difference amongst the various bills or whatever outcome will happen after we actually after you actually appropriate.
So with that introduction, again, we'd like to come back to the conclusion that both institutions have already made a significant investment in this opportunity. We're well poised to move forward. And with additional support from the state, we'd like to be able to build on both organizations' investment and expertise to move forward. And I would remind you that all the details of the economic impact study and other policies of the partnership are available on the web at this URL. And with that, we'd be happy to answer questions.
Representative Goodwin and then Representative Mallory.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I already got the chair in my way there. I can't see you. I have a few questions here. Now, I hear you keep saying $70 million, and yet Representative Demmer's bill has $75 million in it. How much is enough?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we're trying to be honest. Our original plan called for $70 million, and so that's the number we've continued to use. Last year, the Senate introduced a bill that said $75 million, and certainly that extra $5 million would be well spent, but I wouldn't quibble over the five, but I certainly would quibble over the difference between $33 million in the next biennium or $15 million in the next biennium, because that's substantial.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Goodwin.
I think you know we have a budget deficit right now, a budget shortfall of, with inflation, about $1.3 billion. So I'm kind of wondering where you would like us to take that money from in the first place. And then I'd like to know the number. There's a couple of questions here, and I'll repeat them if you need me to. The number of new people who will be hired with this money, and where it's coming from in our budget, and if the state has any gets any access to the intellectual property rights of your research, or who makes money off of that.
Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Goodwin. As far as I'll take the first question about where the money will come from, Representative Goodwin, I don't think we have targets or we don't have a defined amount yet to say where it's coming from what. That's like saying where's the money in our education budget coming from, or where's the money in our health and human services budget coming from. It's not the general fund. This is an investment the state would be making in this, and we're taking this as part of the, I guess you'd have to say that whatever we take for education is coming out of every place else. Whatever we take from here is coming from every place else. The same.
Oh,
in terms of the
point, to that point,
Representative Goodwin,
thank you. To that point, that would be fine if we had money in the budget. We don't have money in the budget, so it has to come from somewhere else. So I'm wondering if you're thinking about where that's going to come
from.
Well,
Representative Goodwin, I think we've got about $30 billion in the budget, and I think what Representative Demmer is saying is we haven't decided where we're spending any of it yet. We haven't decided what the targets are going to be for anything. This bill will be carried by Representative Gunther's committee. It'll be in the jobs finance bill is where it's headed. After assuming it gets out of here and out of commerce, it'll be going to jobs. So it'll be in his bill. The debate that that you're having, I think it's a good one, is how big is the jobs bill going to be? How big is the education bill going to be? How big is the health and human services bill going to be? We haven't had that debate yet as a legislature, and I think that it's a little premature to say where's it going to come from, because I think Representative Demmer is right. It's going to come from the general fund, the $30 billion, give or take, that is there. The issue is going to be how big is the jobs bill going to be, and how much of this project can we get into Representative Gunther's bill?
Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, if I could, another way we could look at that, the governor's budget proposal is an increase of almost $1.9 billion for the biennium, and this is looking at, for the biennium would be 2 years, this would be $30 million of the $1.9 billion increase. So we'd be, if you want to look at it in that fashion, we're not touching the budget as was there before. If you want to look at it as taking part of the $1.9 billion increase for the biennium, we're taking about $30 million of that for this to make this investment. That's another way to look at it, I think.
Representative Goodwin.
Mr. Chair and Representative Demmer, the money still has to come from somewhere. And we're not saying we've got $1.9 billion extra dollars coming in the next 2 years from nowhere. And we're not saying that there's not inflation in the other programs that haven't been accounted for whatsoever. So I'm really just trying to make sense out of this, because if I brought a bill before this committee that costs this kind of money, I would definitely expect to have to find a source for that funding. So I think we should all kind of think about that when our budget is in such bad shape. We should have to think about where that funding is going to come from, because somebody's going to lose out when somebody else makes it, especially when there's only fees being raised. So I guess my next question was, how many new people will be hired with this money? First, I haven't got an answer to why you have $75 million when they're saying $70
million. That's a good question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Demmer.
Representative Goodwin, when I got the bill, it was $15 million for 5 years. I think it was just for convenience. The governor put this together, and that's what we're going to do. Representative Cole's bill is $15 million for 1 year, and we have to choose if we want to do this each year or go out into the out years. Get back to that first question, if I could, Mr. Chair. Representative, the money comes from income taxes, it comes from sales taxes, it comes from excise taxes. That's where the money comes from, Representative Goodwin. We have an 8 or 9% increase in the revenues coming into the state. In my business, when I have additional revenues in my business, I have to make decisions where I'm going to spend that additional revenue, whether I spend it on inventory, people, equipment, vehicles. In the state of Minnesota, we have $1.9 billion of increased money coming into the state from taxes, and that's our job here, is to figure out where we're going to invest that money over and above what we've been spending in the past. And that's what we're deciding here, is if we want some of that money to go toward this investment.
And Representative Demmer, we're not deciding it here, of course. We're going to be deciding that issue in Representative Gunther's committee after we have the debate on the floor about what his target's going to be.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When I meant here, I meant in St. Paul, the capital, us as a legislature as a whole. If I could comment on the jobs before I let the doctors talk about their specific thing. One of the things that was talked about in the last committee is the job element and where the job's going to come from. And it's important to keep in mind that while this is going to create employment for both Mayo and for the University of Minnesota, the economic development that's being talked about really is through the commercialization and use of the intellectual property that they'll be coming up with, and hopefully creating companies that will pay taxes, that will hire people, that will be the engine that we're looking for to develop our economy here in the state of Minnesota and provide those jobs. So I think it's the spin-off companies and the growth of that infrastructure as a result of this research and technology. That's really what we're after. Now I can let the doctors speak to what they think it might mean for Mayo and IBM and for the partnership.
Mr. Chair, Representative Goodwin, these are the Trip Umbach projections for jobs that would emanate from partnership activity over these three time scenarios under the three success scenarios that Dr. Peller introduced. So again, focusing on the near term and on the mid-level scenario, their projections are that there would be over 4,000 new jobs created by the partnership by 2010. And that includes both direct jobs and indirect jobs. So people hired directly with partnership and partnership-derived and leveraged dollars, and downstream effects on the overall state employment picture.
Mr. Chair, to that question, my question is, I saw that and I understand that, but my question is, how many jobs is this money going to create? Not spinoffs. You really, I mean, I know you've got some good accountant to probably take as good a look at that as they can, but you really have no idea. I mean, it's really very almost impossible to say you're going to have that many spin-off jobs out of the research. So what I really would like to know is how much this $70 million is going to create jobs at the university and at the Mayo Clinic for now.
Dr. Paula.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, these projections are based on actually the historical records from Mayo Clinic and the University of Minnesota. So we do know what we can estimate the number of new companies and the number of employees. Obviously, at the beginning, a startup company will have fewer than two dozen employees, and those numbers are factored in here, and that's why the number goes up so much in the distal years, and I would agree with you that it's much more speculative if we look 10 or 15 years out. The more directly to your question, the U.S. Commerce Department calculates that for every $1 million of research funding that's in Minnesota, that's 38.1 jobs. Now, that's the direct effect of just investing in these research projects. We predict that there will be a multiplier in terms of new NIH grants that will be anywhere from 0.5 to 3 times that, again, based on our recent historical records of what happens when we seed these very high-profile, likely-to-succeed projects. So, again, if you say that that's going to be a doubling, then we're up to about 70 jobs for every initial $1 million in research that we invest in. And so that's where this projection actually comes from.
Representative Mallory?
Oh. I have one more question there.
Representative Goodwin.
Okay, on the intellectual property rights, how much money do you expect to make off of the state with this money that you're being allocated here, and how much of that do you think would be fair to reimburse the state for this kind of a large investment?
Director Pollard.
Mr. Chair, Representative Goodwin. I think in principle it's fair for all of that money to be reinvested in the public interest just as the initial money is. When we spoke about how, when we initially planned this and had discussions with the Attorney General's office and everyone else in the state when we originally put together a business plan, we concluded that the simplest way to do this is to merely return the proceeds, whatever they are, that come directly back to the partnership into partnership activities and to continue that. And quite frankly, we'd let you know what that is, and we wouldn't be asking for more money if this is successful. The difficulty of returning it in a different way, that is having the state be a partner in the startups, et cetera, is very difficult from a business standpoint in terms of negotiating licenses. And it also is a different format than what we're required to do by federal law under the Bayh-Dole Act, where we're required to actually process and to license the intellectual property on behalf of the original funder. And so when we put all these things together, we thought it would be easiest if we apply the principles of the Bayh-Dole Act to the state money as well. Again, hoping that the state's initial seeding of some of these projects will also then have federal money invested on the further development, and all of that, any of those returns would accrue to the partnership and therefore for state-sponsored types of activities.
To that point, Mr.
Representative Goodwin, we have a number of people on the list.
I understand that. The issue there then is that the act that you're talking about, the federal act, says that you have to return it to the funder. Well, the funder in this case would be the state. It does not say that.
Dr. Pollard.
The Bayh-Dole Act transfers the title to the recipient of the funds as long as the recipient then makes good faith efforts to commercialize that intellectual property and specifies that the returns have to be split amongst the institution and the inventor per se. And that's been something that's been going on now since 1980 and has been overall very successful and has really changed the ability to get university or research institution discoveries into the to the marketplace because of that requirement.
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My first question is any of the used budget or some of the money through Health and Human Services going into anything like this?
Dr. Pollard, or?
I don't know which to ask, but somebody up there.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, this is certainly outside of the scope of the request that the university has made. Obviously, there is a lot of synergy in what we're going to be able to do, and the major synergy is that we're taking advantage not only of whatever we're able to fund at the university, but also whatever the whatever Mayo Clinic is able to fund and taking advantage of this. But this is not anything that is specifically represented in the university's request. To a small extent, some of the infrastructure investment we might be able to make, et cetera, might be able to backfill some of what we had to forego in the previous decreases in the university's allocations, but they really are quite separate. And this has a specific goal of developing, of performing research which has a direct therapeutic impact in a relatively short term, and that's not something that, as in general, the university's funding is specifically allocated for.
What about,
Representative Mullery?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What about on Mayo? Anything through other budgets here at the
Mr. Decker, Representative, Mayo currently puts over $120 million a year into our research efforts, and a large component of that is research that's directly applicable to this type of work. Again, the request of the state here is to encourage partnership with the university to let us be able to move beyond the process of fundamental research and into the commercialization arena. and generate enough dollars to let this become a self-sustaining partnership between these two institutions. As Dr. Pallard noted, it is our intent here to put every dollar that comes back from commercialization of these findings from the partnership back into the partnership, so this becomes a self-sustaining engine on both the scientific and a commercial standpoint.
Mr. Chairman, another area, and I think Representative Goodman started to touch, in fact, got into it. I'm concerned from, and I haven't followed it in recent years, and maybe there's changes, but when I worked at the University Attorney's Office, we had very little follow-up as far as getting the money off of the patents that came through either the med school, which I was assigned to, or the IT. And we didn't really ever track down getting the money from that. In private practice later, I had some clients who were at Mayo, and even though they invented things right on their job there, Mayo let them have the patent totally. In fact, one of them I remember I had to give up to an international law firm when he started branching into his patents in Germany and France and everything else in Spain. But they didn't get anything off of it at that time. Has that, in other words, if we're given money to you to do this, it concerns me a lot that we don't have an extremely tight thing where we're getting an awful lot of money back to either that institution or the state somehow from patents. Has that been tightened up a lot in the last, say, dozen years or something like that?
Dr. Pauler, as you answer that, Representative Mueller, I think that's a great question. As you answer that, could you talk a little bit about, remind the committee a little bit about the Office of Business Development that's been created as a part of the partnership as you answer his question?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative. And I'm glad you asked that question because things have changed dramatically. As Eric mentioned in his introductory remarks, according to the most recent study, the University of Minnesota is in the top five, actually, of income based on our royalties. So we clearly have tightened that up. In addition, our largest revenue source is for one drug, an antiviral drug. We successfully sued Glaxo to prevent them from infringing upon the patent that they had licensed, and that was a big deal. And it was also a big deal for some local attorneys who made a lot of money on that, and that was fine because they did a great job. We have started, again, being cognizant of the need to really be aggressive about commercializing what comes out of the university and also Mayo Clinic. We've recently opened an Office of Business Development, which is located in the University Enterprise Laboratory, which is an incubator park in one of the biozones that was created 2 years ago. The Office of Business Development is designed to help work with existing and startup companies and help them to develop university intellectual property. What's important about the Office of Business Development is that the Mayo Clinic has a branch of their tech transfer office physically located in that same suite, actually in the same office. So we're working together. So the partnership already has an office here in the Twin Cities where side by side we can commercialize these inventions. And the last thing I did want to mention is that a couple months ago we summarized our experience in an op-ed piece that I wrote in the Star Tribune, and in the last several years we've had 99 startups just from the university, and 73 of those are in Minnesota. So to anticipate the other question is, how do we know that all of this is doing good for Minnesota? That's my answer to that. So we're clearly doing well on a national scale, and we're trying to favor Minnesota as to where these new companies incubate and develop. And hopefully we'll get another Medtronic out of this.
We have Representative
Chairman. Just could I also hear? Because I was concerned about.
I'll let you ask your question. We do have Representative Loeffler, Zellers, and Liebling on the list, and we have two additional witnesses who want to testify. So ask members to keep that in mind. We're gonna we've got another committee time, other committees meeting later on this afternoon. I'd like to get this wrapped up. We could,
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Mulery, go ahead.
I didn't need quite as long an answer from the U. But I was even more concerned about Mayo. They tightened up and maybe a little shorter.
The shorter answer is that clearly times have changed, and that all academic institutions realize now that income from commercialization activities is going to be a vital component of our ability to be competitive moving forward. And again, Mayo currently ranks in the top 10 for number of patents received. And in terms of dollars back from each patent, it's on an increasing trajectory. And have there been instances where maybe a given patent was not commercialized by Mayo but was given back to the inventor? I'm sure there have been, but I think that's really the outlier, and there's a lot of scrutiny given to each patent that is pursued because there's a significant investment involved.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And yes, I hope that as you implement this, you'll continue to keep that attitude towards keeping the jobs in the Twin Cities and in greater Minnesota and not in other countries, other parts of the United States, because I think that's the commitment if we do put state dollars into this. I would say on the patent area, I've actually been approached by a law school student in my area who was trying to find a typical type of summer job as you're going through law school and with a law firm that has done a lot of patent work and has the university as a client, and was told that they aren't hiring because they are now having some of that preliminary work being done offshore in a foreign country. And I think we really, particularly in this kind of area where we're really competitive with not only other states but other countries, we really need to look at that job creation as well as chain of command in terms of access to intellectual property all the way along. And I hope that as you pursue the patents, that's something. You don't need to respond to it, but I do think that's something you need to watch as you're doing contracting. My question was about, I remember that the governor in his State of the State address down in Rochester mentioned how he was securing, and I think Dr. Waller-Pollard had mentioned that earlier about how you're seeking private funds. I think the governor had made a comment that he was expecting to get $5 million from Medica. And I'd like to understand a little bit more about this public-private partnership, and is that being given to the partnership as a grant, like a nonprofit would give a grant, just as you're expecting the state to, or do they have some ownership, or how does that part of the relationship get addressed? Because I don't see that here.
Dr. Pollard.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, you know, unfortunately, as much about that commitment as we do. We've been working with the governor's office to determine more about this pledge for $5 million. We intend that the money would be used by the partnership in exactly the same way without any additional strings attached or commitments, and indeed any money that came from private sector, the returns would come back to the partnership and be reinvested just as I've already described. At this point in time, there is not a formal agreement for that dollars, and we're working to try to develop that because obviously we don't want to let an opportunity go by.
Thank you. And Mr. Chairman and Representative Denner, and perhaps this is also to the chairman on his bill, looking at the contrast between the two, it's not just the multi-year appropriation, which I had always heard we couldn't bind future legislators, but there must be a way or no one would have drafted the bill that way. But there's also a significant difference in terms of reporting and accountability, in that the bill that has the most dollars doesn't even have any reporting on impact or, you know, products or, you know, what's happened, and the one-year bill does have some, and it gets enhanced with an amendment potentially, but does it include, for example, this committee, and does it really address sort of some of the issues that have come up in the discussion? So I'm wondering if that area needs a little bit more finessing in both bills in terms of us being accountable to say, hey, we made this investment in this exciting new area. Here's what really resulted.
Representative Loeffler, let me address that. The reporting came on an amendment. You'll notice that House File 1548 is listed as the first engrossment. That happened in the Jobs Committee. It's my understanding from talking to Representative Demmer, I'm sure he'll correct me if I'm wrong, that that he has no problem working that into his bill as well. In fact, the amendment to my bill that we'll be taking up after we finish with Representative Demmer's addresses a concern raised by Representative Mahoney in the Jobs Committee. There's a bit of a convoluted story as to where this money was going to go. Was it going to be in the higher ed budget? Was it going to be in the jobs budget? Initially, the bill was drafted with the money. We thought it was going to be carried by Representative Nornes and his bill. The intention of everybody is that that has now changed. It's going to be in Representative Gunther's bill. I chose to leave the report for the higher ed committees in the bill because I think it's important. I certainly have no opposition to expanding that reporting requirement. I think it's important that we understand what institutions like the partnership are doing with monies that we provide to them. I hope that Representative Demmer is in agreement with that, and as this moves out of here, if he's willing to basically incorporate the language that I have in my bill, I think we can probably do that in Commerce or when we get back to jobs. Mm-hmm. Representative Demmer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Absolutely, absolutely. In terms of reporting, I think we're open to, with the partnership, I was going to say, I'm sure we'll be open to any kind of reporting we need to do. Keep in mind they're a nonprofit and the university is a part of that and it's public, so I think there's a lot of reporting that they probably have already just in their partnership type of thing, but I would guess that there's nothing behind closed door here, so anything that I think we can put together if they're willing to do to show what's happening and where it's going.
Representative Zellers and then Representative Liebman. Representative Zellers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and this is for Dr. Pollard or is it Mr. Wheeler?
Liebman,
I'm sorry. And these can be very brief answers if you'd like. How many jobs will be created if we do not approve this bill, a fine bill by Representative Demmer?
Dr. Pollard or Dr. Liebman, you want to take a stab at that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, if we don't fund the bill at all,
mm-hmm.
No new jobs.
Thank you, Dr. Pollard.
Representative Zellers.
And follow-up from that, taking into consideration, we've heard here many, many times about how California's put in $1 billion and our neighbor just across the border, across the river here in Wisconsin, is putting in $500 million. And if memory serves me correct, I think their budget is not substantially less than ours, but it's definitely less than our budget. What are they seeing as a return on their investment, and why would they be doing this if it wasn't a good return on investment?
Dr. Pollard, Dr. Lieber?
Mr. Chair, Representative, let's see, I didn't go to law school, but I think I'm supposed to say that's highly speculative and I won't allow it. I don't know. Actually, California is investing $3 billion, not $1 billion. Oh. And Wisconsin, the total package is $750 million, although some of that is for seed funds to invest in what comes out of their activities. So that's clearly an important aspect. I will speculate that they clearly see the value in investing in their research institutions, I just hope that Minnesotans will also see that. And you know, we're not asking for $3 billion because that's an awful large number that I couldn't defend in lieu of all the other needs that we have. But we will lose our position if we don't continue to invest. And I don't think that $70 million is outrageous, considering what other states have already agreed is a worthy investment. But using the same types of analyses, doing the same kind of work.
Thank you, Dr. Pollard and Chairman. Just to follow up, I think that's a pretty safe number that we're using here. I think it's a pretty safe investment. I think we've seen what innovative companies Minnesotans will come up with, both with help and on their own. I think this is a very prudent and fiscally, conservative number for our state and for our committee. And I thank Representative Demmer for bringing the bill forward. And Dr. Paul, you shouldn't give him a shot at the $3 billion or the billion-dollar number. See how good Representative Demmer really is.
Mr. Chairman, to that point, real quick.
To that point, and then Representative Liebling, and then we're going to have the other two witnesses come up. And Representative Goodwin, if you have another question, we'll bring Dr. Weaven and Dr. Pollard back up. I'd like to keep this moving.
Mr.
Representative
Chairman, Mullins, very quickly, I just wondered if Representative Sellers was being recruited by the major leagues to pitch batting practice for the home run derby.
If he's not, he should be. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to go back to the issue about how much is being requested here because on the slides, I thought the request was the $33 million in the first 2 years, and neither of these bills does that. And so, you know, what do you have to say about that? I mean, do we need to amend the bill? And also, you had a split between the first 2 years, which is definitely not represented here either.
Dr. Pollard.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, the budget is the ideal. It is a total of $70 million over 5 years. If you ask me what would be the best way to invest that, ignoring politics and everything else, it would be $33 million in this next 2 years because we have a backlog of projects. Okay. Again, the difference between $30 million from Representative Demmer and $33 million can be made up in subsequent years, and so I wouldn't argue, and I'm grateful for the support of something that's close enough. If you want to do what we recommend as the best way to do it, it'd be $33 million this biennium, $23.5 million next biennium, and then $13.5 million would be the remainder of that $70 million.
Representative Liebling, it's a great point, and I think that it's worth noting for all the members on this committee that the partnership, the governor's office, everybody is very, we're not set in stone with 30, we're not set in stone with 15, we're working on this number as the budget process moves forward. Obviously, we've got another 2 months or so of session left, and it's going to be a while before we know where we're at, but it's sort of a work in progress still, and the partnership has been more than willing to work with the legislature, to work with the governor's office, in trying to figure out something that works for everybody, works for our budget situation, works for the partnership, so that they can move forward in as aggressive fashion as possible.
Well, just a quick follow-up, Mr. Chair. I mean, it just seems to me that, you know, the difference in dollars isn't that much, but I mean, if these folks with all these analyses that have been done and these scenarios that have been set out are saying that we need to front load this, because, you know, I think that's a very important consideration, and I certainly hope that, I guess we don't want to amend the bill today to do that, but, you know, I certainly hope that full consideration will be given to that, because obviously, you know, we're not putting in $3 billion, and if we don't apply what's needed at the right time, we could really be missing opportunities. I mean, that's the whole idea, is to sort of kickstart this thing at the beginning. So I'd really like to kind of put in a plug to make sure that we do that.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Next, Twyla Brace.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Twyla Brace from Citizens Council on Healthcare. And if I understand correctly, maybe the chair could help on this. This bill will not have testimony in the full Commerce Committee?
Ms. Brace, that is ultimately going to be up to Chair Wilkin. I have not had a discussion with him. What we did with the previous bills that came out of the division is that they were presented to the committee. I believe, if my recollection is correct, there was actually a little bit of testimony provided on the R&D tax credit, I think, if I'm thinking of the right committee hearing. Members of the committee will be before the committee, the Commerce Committee, and members of that committee will have an opportunity to act on the bill in any way they so choose. And I trust that Chair Wilkin, if there are people who are interested in testifying and don't feel that they've had an opportunity to do so, we'll try to accommodate them. The bill will, just so members understand and so that interested parties understand, after the bill leaves the Commerce Committee, assuming that it does, it will be re-referred to our Representative Gunther's committee. That will be its resting point until he puts together his omnibus bill. Ms. Brace.
Okay, Mr. Chair, before I start, let me just mention two things. One is that I've been informed by individuals that they have sent letters for testimony to this committee, but I've also been informed that that wasn't included as part of the testimony. Is that correct?
Ms. Brace, I'm not exactly sure what you're referring to. I did receive an email from somebody, but there was no request that it be distributed any broader than an email to me. If individuals want, we're all very accessible by email. And in fact, I think today alone I probably received about 250 emails about one particular legislative proposal from people all over the state. So we're certainly accessible, and I would encourage anybody who wants to contact members of this division to do so.
Mr. Chair, then what I'll do is I'll make sure that those who thought that they had sent testimony will actually make sure that it gets into Representative Wilkins' chair as testimony.
That's a great idea, Ms. Brace. Could you please proceed with your
yes.
testimony?
The second thing that this committee needs to understand, which is one of the things that I distributed to you, which starts with the topic distributed to Technology, Bioscience, and Medical Divisions, is that this particular hearing on this bill does not seem to have been very available to the public, and I want you to know that it's a little, I mean, we think it's serious that the public would find it difficult, since this particular committee has been introduced regularly as having its own committee hearings, but this bill is, as you'll notice on the bottom, only mentioned at the bottom of the Commerce Committee, and not even the topic of the bill is listed. And then finally, of course, Mr. Chair, your bill isn't even listed there. And perhaps you don't know, but this is the first national week of Sunshine Week. And so we think it's very important that there be the ability for the public to know what is actually going to be heard. So my suggestion to you is that when this committee continues to have hearings, that you will keep up having it just under that committee so that people will actually be able to find the bills and know what the topic is. Now, Mr. Chair, my testimony is, as I brought before the ethics, the meeting that was on ethics, is that we have wanted patient consent, and it's important for you to understand why for this bill there needs to be patient consent. So we do not feel that medical research should ever be a prerequisite for access to treatment, that patients should not be guinea pigs. They're not a means to an end. You can recall Tuskegee, where there was research and the people didn't know. There's the Nuremberg Code, which says that voluntary consent of the human subject is absolutely essential. Genetic research presents real dangers to patients, discrimination, social status, emotional concerns as a part of finding out what they didn't know and they didn't want to find out. And then genetic research includes activities that may be opposed by the subjects of the research or violate the ethical, moral, cultural, or religious values and beliefs. And DNA cannot be made unidentifiable. When it comes to actual laws, state and federal, the Minnesota government has full access to all medical record data, and I provided you a form actually laying out for you the laws in Minnesota having to do with the health department's access, having to do with exceptions for researchers, et cetera, so that you could see what the law says. And federal laws, in particular, the federal common rule allows IRBs to waive patient consent. The HIPAA privacy rule allows access to identifiable data for medical research using something called a limited data set. And then the August guidance from the Office of Human Research Protections has expanded use of identifiable but unidentified medical data in human tissues without patient consent. So there's a lot of genetic research that can take place without patient consent, is our point. Genetic research also is not often specified in consent forms or separated as a separate consent decision item. And I happen to know lots of folks who look through the different consent forms at the different institutions just to try and find the part that says research. But there have been articles written saying that even though they do that, even though they cross out the research section, unless the institution itself has some kind of log for who has not consented to research, the research will go on. And lots of people have been treated at Mayo before they even knew about genetic research. 1906, when the tissue started being collected, was a long time ago, and 10 million tissues represent a lot of patients. Most patients do not know that Mayo and other institutions are storing their tissues and serums collected in the process of their clinical care. I wonder if you knew. Maybe now as a result of this, you do. And as well, children who are treated at Mayo grow up and become adults who never gave consent to their research or to have themselves part of any kind of genetic research. What we ask you to remember is that people are first and foremost human beings deserving of dignity, respect, and a right to refuse having their thoughts, lives, and body parts probed for research of any sort. Government-approved, unconsented research on human tissues and fluids creates a slippery slope toward government conscription of bodies and organs for transplantation. And in case you think that this is sort of unusual, it was actually written up in, I believe it was Harvard, why we should all have our organs conscripted at the end of our life for use for everyone else. Medical ethics and patient rights supersede all state business initiatives, and although this might be a very good idea, it's not a good idea if the people in the state can no longer trust in their institutions to look at their rights and preserve them. And at stake is the integrity of medical research, patient trust, the patient-doctor relationship, the integrity of the medical profession, and the rights and dignity of patients. So, in the end, what we want is a patient consent requirement attached to genetic research, and we have laid out the reasons why. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Brace. Do members have questions for Ms. Brace? Next, we have Dr. Karen Ephraim. Welcome to the committee, Dr. Ephraim. Could you please state your name and proceed with your testimony?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you. My name is Dr. Karen Ephraim. I am here as a mother of three, a board-certified pediatrician, and a taxpayer, as well as a board member of the Alliance for Human Research Protection, to raise concerns about this bill, not necessarily that public dollars are going to be used to fund this kind of research, but that there are inadequate patient consent provisions. So I'm gonna raise a couple of other issues that Ms. Grace did not. The research agenda of genetic research is something that is rapidly evolving and hasn't necessarily kept up with an adequate discussion of ethics and consent. And that's one reason why I think it's very important. Second reason is public-private partnerships allow the private part to be not available to the public when they want to raise concerns about issues such as this. And then there's several other implications and problems with this situation. One is the issue of private property. Are the tissues and the serum and the things that could potentially be used without patient consent, as Ms. Brace laid out, the property of the patient, or are they the property of the institution or the state that's funding them? Contract. A patient makes an implicit or an explicit contract with their health care provider to receive certain services for certain specific problems that they have discussed with their health care provider. There's nothing in that implicit or explicit contract that would allow research involving the very material of life to be performed on that patient's blood or tissue when it's not discussed. And I would submit, and Ms. Braves would submit, that it's not adequately discussed. Individual rights versus research progress are the common good. Without specific consent requirements, it is too easy for a researcher or an institution to see their work or the advancement of research or the finding of a cure for a terrible disease as more important than the consent of an individual patient. Data privacy. if this research is done under the inadequate consent provisions that we have now, very private medical and genetic information is available for institutions, for the state, and potentially for private groups, especially under a public-private partnership like this, that could result in data profiling that would have the patient targeted for medical procedures or pharmaceuticals, or have employment or insurance implications. And then finally, eugenics. The Center for Genetics and Society listed the following among their implications of genetic research that is not carefully controlled. They said new technologies of discrimination and control, cloning and genetic redesign would mean unprecedented control by some people over the lives and life prospects of others. And not necessarily saying that this is funding cloning, but genetic research done still can have these kinds of eugenics concerns. And I would add particularly for the disabled. The center also said people with disabilities are acutely aware that they are likely targets of any kind of eugenic selection, and the eugenic norms of perfection could all too easily displace values of care and respect. A techno-eugenic world could increasingly come to regard disabled people as mistakes who should not have been allowed to be born. Now, that's an extreme situation, but that's why consent is so important. Their summary statement contained the following paragraph. The new human genetic technologies present a threshold challenge for humanity. If used properly, they hold great promise for treating disease and alleviating suffering. If abused, they could open the door to a powerful new eugenics that would objectify human life and undermine the foundations of human society. The choice is up to us, and I just say that in your efforts to do good, to be very, very aware of the issues of consent and the ethics around it. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Heffern. I've become familiar with Ms. Brace's organization, and I believe I may have heard you speak previously, Ms. Heffern, but I'm not familiar with the Alliance for Human Research Protection. Can you tell me a little bit about that organization? What is it? Who is it?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. It is an organization out of New York. It is a organization made up of both lay people and professionals that are dealing with multiple issues of human research and consent and those types of things, anything from drugs, recently the antidepressants, and the fact that the FDA has not adequately safeguarded them from use in children when they have been shown in multiple studies to be not effective and causing suicidal effects.
If I wanted to find out some more information about this group, Dr. Heffern, could I go online?
Yes.
Is there a website or something?
Yes.
So members of the committee, if they want to track
Absolutely.
This down, can probably go to Google or one of the search engines, type this in, and find
it's
the organization online.
www.ahrp.org.
Thank you, Dr. Heffern.
Thank you very much.
Members have questions? Right. Representative Goodwin, I think you may have had a question. I didn't mean to cut you off, but I wanted to make sure we had the witnesses. Did you have another question for Dr. Paul or Dr. Wieben?
Mr. Chair, I'll skip it. I can't remember
it anymore. Right. Representative Demmer, anything further?
No, Mr. Chair. I think this is important stuff that we're doing here. I don't think there's anything that we'll deal with in a period of time when you look at going forward. I think it's something we can all be very proud that we had a part in getting started. The whole biotechnology and medical genomics field is evolving, it's growing, and it's exciting, and it's very important work. And I think it's an investment that we can make in the state of Minnesota that probably has as much economic potential as anything we've done for a long, long time. So, Mr. Chair, with that, my testimony, and appreciate the support of the committee.
Thank you, Representative Demmer. And with that, the chair will renew his motion that House File 434 be recommended to pass and referred to the full Commerce Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Same sign.
No.
Motion prevails. Next on the agenda is House File 1548, which is my bill. The only difference between my bill and Representative Demmer's bill is the reporting requirement that Representative Loeffler pointed out, and also my bill provides the funding for 1 year as opposed to the 5 years. I will move House File 1548 be recommended to pass and referred to the full Commerce Committee. I would also at this time move the A1 amendment. Members, what the A1 amendment does is adds an additional reporting requirement that as you look at 1548, there's a requirement that a report be provided to the higher ed committees. This adds a requirement that the appropriate committee in the Senate and the House, the jobs committees, if you will, receive a copy of that report as well. With that, unless members have questions, I move the A1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Members, unless there are specific questions about 1548, I think we can go ahead and act on it. Anybody in the audience care to testify either in favor of or in opposition to House File 1548? Other than what we've heard on Representative Demmer's bill, I assume we can carry over the testimony, both pro and con, to this bill. Seeing none, the chair will remove his motion that House File 1548, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the full Commerce Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The motion is adopted. Representative Pepin moves approval of the minutes of the Thursday, March 3rd meeting of the division. Any additions, corrections, or deletions to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The minutes are adopted, and we are adjourned. Thank you, members.